and welcome to episode 27 of the Functional Nerds. My name is Patrick Hester, and Lou Anders doesn't want me to tell you anything more.
And I am John Anilio. I write songs about science fiction and fantasy. You can find all my stuff at scifisongs.blogspot.com. You can get my album for free at johnanilio.bandcamp.com, and you can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/johnanilio. Each week, here on the Functional Nerds, we have a third nerd, and mostly it's been science fiction and fantasy authors, and we're keeping with that tradition this week. And our guest this week is Pyre author. He has three books out from Pyre, and he has a lot of other short stories and things out there, and that is James Eng. Say hello, James. Nerd. Oh, yes. Yeah, we're delighted to have you here, James. Yes?
Ipsa scientis potestas est.
Ipsa scientes. I didn't get that last part.
It's been a long time. Potestas est?
You're able to know things?
Knowledge is power.
Oh, scientia est potentia.
There you go. It's been so long.
Oh, well.
John, do you even know what we're doing?
I have no idea what you're doing.
He teaches Latin.
Oh, okay.
I took Latin in high school. It's one of the few schools I've ever heard of that actually taught Latin.
Wow. Wow.
Well, I wanted to take it in high school, but they wouldn't let me.
I took it because it was the only, it was the weirdest class you could possibly take as a foreign language. So it had to be me.
Well, anyway, so let's talk about that a little bit. So James has a few novels out from Pyre now. Blood of Ambrose is nominated for the World Fantasy Novel Award. Is that correct?
I think it's correct, although every now and then I have to, you know, drink another slop of coffee and make sure that I'm not dreaming, because it just stunned me when I read the awards nominees rather. But I guess I'm on the short list for the novel this year.
Awesome. Well, congratulations. That's really great news, and we're pleased to have you now, because I'm sure in another couple of months you wouldn't really
the luster will be gone.
Well, I'm sure you wouldn't deal with the dregs of our show in a few months. You'll be riding high on your World Fantasy Award. But thanks for joining us.
In my stretch limousine, I'll be giving interviews on success.
Yes, exactly. So thanks for joining us. And so why don't you tell us a little bit, you know, we can go into your history a little bit, but why don't you tell us a little bit about Blood of Ambrose and your main character, Morlock, and maybe your other books and how those characters developed and how they ended up in these novels?
Good deal. Well, my theory about Morlock is that he's a sword and sorcery character. So he's sword and sorcery characters have to be marginalized somehow. They're usually past their prime, or they're just starting out, or they're outsiders somehow. So even if it's a kind of, you know, almost traditional epic storyline, as you could argue in some ways Blood of Ambrose is, he's still a sword and sorcery character acting like a sword and sorcery character. So in some ways, he doesn't fit the plot, but that was on purpose. It wasn't an accident.
I see.
He's a drunk. He's the greatest wonder worker in the world, but he's had a disappointing life and he takes it out by drinking. He's between 400 and 500 years old. He doesn't keep track anymore. Merlin is his father and they have a conflicted relationship. I know lots about Morlock. I've written so much about Morlock. I know him almost too well.
Well, why don't you, you know, I'm pretty sure that, so Blood of Ambrose, even though it's your first novel published, is Blood of Ambrose your first published novel, period?
Yes. Okay. I have written other novels, but thankfully they have all been destroyed.
And if I'm not mistaken, Morlock, this is not Morlock's first appearance in Blood of Ambrose. He appeared other places too. Can you tell us about sort of the origins of Morlock and where he was first published?
Well, he was first published in Black Gate, the adventure fantasy magazine John O'Neill and now with Howard Jones puts out. Originally designed to be a quarterly, but they've scaled back and now it's a biannual. But it's this big magazine, comes out twice a year, and What they want is the kind of fiction that I've always wanted to write, which is adventure fantasy. So when I heard about it, I sent a Morlock story to him, and because John works the magazine more or less by himself, it took him a long time to get through the slush, but finally I got an acceptance about a year and a half after I submitted it. And that was Morlock's first appearance, a story called Turn Up This Crooked Way, which that wasn't the original title, but that's the title it was published under. It was published 16 years, roughly the month after it was written.
Ooh. Wow. Wow. Now, how many Morlock short stories were published before Blood of Ambrose came out then?
Oh, boy, I sort of lost track, but 4 or 5.
Okay.
Most of them have appeared in Blackgate, but Howard Jones for a while was editing an adventure fantasy magazine online called Flashing Swords after the old, Lynn Carter anthologies. And a couple of Morlock stories appeared through there, and one appeared it's a piece of flash fiction, actually, but it's still a Morlock story on everydayfiction.com. So he's appeared a few places.
I see. Now, how did the short stories eventually lead to the publication of Blood of Ambrose? Can you tell us a little bit about the story of how, you went from writing these short stories to writing the novel and eventually getting it published?
Sure. I mean, I thought that was the traditional route. I thought that's what you were supposed to do. So I wrote for decades. I wrote sword and sorcery stories for a magazine market that didn't want to publish sword and sorcery. Fortunately, I had a sort of day job to fall back on. And once I got a couple of stories published, I figured it was time for a novel. So I figured it'd be a Morlock novel. Mm-hmm. And the story coalesced around Morlock. The trouble with Morlock is that he doesn't say much. If he says, it's a big line for him. So he needs to have other people in the story with him who talk more. Mm-hmm. So it was going to have to be about Morlock and somebody else, and somebody else is collected around him.
I see. And just to interject there, I did just finish reading Blood of Ambrose, and to sort of, piggyback on your point, Morlock shrugs a lot. that's his response to quite a bit. And it's also, I love that about his character. It says so much about his character. Unfortunately, as you said, it probably doesn't help a whole lot in moving the story forward if he was the only character in it. You can't just have a guy shrugging off everything and that be the only thing that happens in the story.
It's true, but he does actually do a lot. That's his saving grace as a character. He's always doing stuff instead of talking about it. And I find it almost too easy to write dialogue. That's one of the reasons I saddled myself with a character who doesn't talk much. Because, I think of all these late Heinlein novels. I'm not saying I write dialogue as well as late Heinlein, but just endless pages of dialogue and the story goes nowhere. When I found myself writing like that, I knew I needed a character who was crunchier and killed someone every now and then, just to liven things up.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. So these short stories also have other characters that are part of it, or is in the short stories, is it mostly just Morlock, or did you add the characters specifically for Blood of Ambrose?
Well, a few of the characters that appear in Blood of Ambrose have a history with Morlock, so some of them appear in the stories too. But the thing about some of the stories are Morlock only, or Morlock facing an antagonist, who's often a very verbose antagonist because Morlock isn't, but frequently there's another character, a narrator who isn't Morlock, or a central figure who isn't Morlock, and Morlock sort of is on the fringes of the story almost.
It's interesting that you point that out, James, because that it is a very unique type. Blood of Ambrose has a unique construction because of that, because the main character is Morlock, and I'd heard you on another podcast, and I've heard Lou Anders of Pyre talk about the book on other podcasts, and it's Morlock is your main character, but in reading the book, especially early on, it's not all about him, as you said, and it's a very unique sort of framework, especially for something that can be considered fantasy, because generally fantasy, there's either the one sort of hero's journey. I guess that's a part of the point that I can make, is that oftentimes in fantasy, it's the hero's journey. And even though Morlock is your hero, he's not, at least it wasn't an apparent hero's journey to me. He is sort of on the outside of the action. Well, I shouldn't say the action, but the outside of some of the storyline. And it took a while for me as a reader to sort of plug into sort of the rhythm of the book, because oftentimes in fantasy, you know, you'll kind of get it right away within the first like 15 pages or so. It's like, oh, this is what's going to happen here. And it took a little work, but it was ultimately quite rewarding, because I liked that it was this sort of different kind of structure to it. Is that generally how you go about writing? I mean, have you written a lot of non-Morlock books as well, or non-Morlock stories as well? Or for the most part, have you done mostly Morlock work at this point?
Well, I've got some non-Morlock work in my files. I'm trying to broaden out. But the thing about Morlock, because in some ways he's an intractable main character, because like I say, he doesn't talk much. He has a very set idea about mm-hmm. what he's going to do. Sometimes I need there's two stories in Blood of Ambrose, really. There's the outer story about the threat, and then there's an inner story about somebody's maturation. Mm-hmm. And the little king, Lathmar, he's the hero of the inner story, and Morlock is sort of the hero of the outer story. And they come together because Morlock represents a kind of father figure to the king. So their stories are sort of hooked together.
I think that's a good way of describing it. That's kind of the way that I felt about it, kind of going through it. What can you tell us about, let's back up for a second. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what got you interested in writing Sword and Sorcery? You described how you wrote Sword and Sorcery for decades, mm-hmm. trying to get it published. What got you interested in writing in general, and maybe writing Sword and Sorcery specifically?
Well, I guess, I, like most people who get into this sort of thing, I was an obsessive reader as a kid. And the stuff that I like lots of stuff, you know, hard science fiction and history and all sorts of stuff. Popular science. I had all of Asimov's popular science books. You know, I read them obsessively too. But the things that really hit me most deeply, starting with Dolaire's Norse Gods and Giants, you know, which is a kid's book, but it's a great kid's book about Norse myth, was the mythical, fantastical stuff. And when I found Tolkien, it was like, you know, the addict's first hit of smack. and later on, Fritz Leiber and Jack Vance, I had much of the same experience with them. Le Guin's Earthsea books, stuff like that. So I was all over that stuff. So when I decided I want to start writing, I figured it would be that kind of, actually more of an epic fantasy thing. But as I started writing more and more, and I got more bored with the epic journey, the quest, they're in the 80s, these books were all over the places. You couldn't swing a dead cat in a bookstore without knocking a bunch of these multi-volume novels off the shelves. And I just got sort of tired of looking at them, and I didn't want to contribute to them. And I thought I wanted to do something more terse, more sort of the fantasy equivalent of what Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler did back in the 20s and 30s, a darker and crunchier. Mm. Sword and Sorcery is that. I mean, that's with Fritz Leiber and Jack Vance and those guys. That's what it's all about.
So how old were you when you started writing your first couple stories then?
Oh, man. That's a depressing thought. I must have been upper teenager before I got really serious about it. I was in my 20s before I started submitting. That was in the 1980s. And mm-hmm. at that point, the market was ever more firmly set against Sword and Sorcery. There are still lots of magazines that say, oh, we'll take fantasy, but no Sword and Sorcery. So maybe I should call it something else, you know.
Yeah.
Now, you were talking about the Norse mythology. I kind of alluded earlier to your day job, teaching mm-hmm. Latin, and you talk about the classics. Mm-hmm. That's one of the things that kind of got me into all of this was, you know, when I took Latin in high school, we also got to study ancient Roman Greece, which I thought was really cool. And we got into their mythology. Mm-hmm. And I was just curious if you had any thoughts on why the Greek and Roman mythology is so popular and why, you know, it's still taught. We still talk about, we don't really talk much about like Norse mythology or, you know, Eastern mythologies, Chinese mythologies, Indian mythology, you know, we don't really talk about that kind of stuff. It's like the Greek and the Roman is what people kind of gravitate towards. I was just curious if you had any thoughts on that.
Well, the Greek and Roman was central to the educational system for millennia. So there's a powerful core of work already there in every European language, especially English. But I think Norse mythology is a lot of places too, especially if the Thor movie makes it big. I think we'll see lots more Norse knockoffs. But go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I love the Greek mythology. I'm nuts about that stuff. But I have to admit that it's the Norse stuff that really speaks to me a little more deeply. Maybe because the gods can be in danger, they're at risk, and in fact, they're doomed. Whereas the Greek gods are almost comic relief when they show up in the Iliad. You know, Ares gets wounded and he goes crying back to Olympus, and Zeus tells him to grow a pair. And when they show up in the Iliad, it's for fun, and it's, the serious stuff is when the heroes are killing each other.
Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with the, is it Mickey Reichardt or
Mickey? Yeah, Mickey Zucker Reichardt.
Yes. Those books.
No, I haven't. I mean, I've recognized the name, but I haven't read her stuff or his stuff.
I don't know, but yeah, those are based on the Norse mythology, and that was actually aside from Thor, which I'm going to say is really loose. Was kind of my first,
thou might say so, Ian Verley.
My first splash into kind of Norse mythology. And, I thought those were really, really good. Really well done. I wish I could remember the name of those. If only there was some sort of tool that we could use to look that up.
Web, you know, all over the world. Yeah.
Yeah. Aside on this, I had a friend in college who was kind of a metalhead. And if you're a metalhead, you're kind of into Norse mythology for some reason. And he had a t-shirt that he had made up himself. It wasn't one that you go buy. He went to like the store and got it all made up with his lettering. And it said, "I survived Ragnarok." I thought it was one of the best t-shirts you could ever have. You know, I just thought that was so clever and so fun. He used to wear that all the time. But Patrick, to sort of talk a little bit about the Greek and Roman, I'm a musician, and I'm a music teacher during the day, and I teach elementary school. So I'm in the education world, although, you know, a different level than you're at. And Patrick, I think one of the reasons why Greek and Roman, as James said, you know, it has a firm base in our education system. It's also time a lot of time. You know, when you're teaching, there's really just only so many hours in the day. So Greek and Roman myth, kind of, if you're talking about mythology at all, especially at the level that I'm at, you get a little bit of Greek and Roman, and that's about it. You know,
yeah. Like,
you're not going to go too deep into anything else. I mean, you know, you don't even get very far into like American history. You know, you just do the same things kind of over and over again. It wasn't until I was in college when American history was something other than, you know, just wars and politics. One of the best classes I took in college was just all about the development of business in the United States. And I thought that was one of the most interesting things because it talked about stuff I'd never heard of and how important that was to our country. But anyway, that's kind of sidetracking a bit. But
and just to throw it out there, it's Mickey Zucker Reichert, and it's the Renshai Chronicles. Mm. Last of the Renshai, Western Wizard, Child of Thunder, Beyond Ragnarok, so on and so forth. Those were great books. Just throwing that out there.
Yeah, Elizabeth Baer did something recently that has a Norse basis, I guess, but I haven't read it yet. Mm. But she's usually pretty good, so that'll be worth checking out too, I think.
Yeah, that's one I've been looking at for a while. I can't – it's all the wind-racked stars. Is that it? Something like that.
Yeah, wind-racked stars.
Yeah, I've been looking at that for months, and I keep there like, and I'm like, that looks, because it's sort of like a sci-fi Norse mythology blend, from what I understand. So
yeah, sort of a post-apocalyptic.
Yes.
If you want your sci-fi Norse stuff, you do need to read Thor, because I seem to remember there was like the alien version of Thor.
Beta Ray Bill.
Yeah, Beta Ray Bill.
Yeah, the horse, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. But
The Marvel comic book drove me nuts because I was such a big fan of the myths, and I was sure that Loki didn't run around with that green thing with all the horns.
Exactly.
I tried to watch the they had a Hulk versus, and it's all these animated movies, and it's Hulk versus Wolverine, Hulk versus, and one of them was Hulk versus Thor. Oh, it was so bad. Oh, it was terrible. I mean, he was actually, you know, in the home of the gods, destroying it, and it was just it was terrible, 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 terrible.
Well, James, one of the things I wanted to ask you about the book, and one of the things that I enjoyed about it was one of the things we talked about before on this show is your use of the sort of having sayings in, I guess we'd call it Dwarvish, and you have Dwarvish lines written here and there, and then you have them translated as footnotes, because at points in this, you know, you really feel like you're reading an actual, almost, you know, account of something that actually happened in history. So I want to ask you a little bit about that, about the Dwarvish language. Did you sort of devise that yourself? Are you drawing from any particular sources when you're doing the language?
Well, when I was in grad school, I made up the Dwarvish language as an exercise. And I guess making up languages is like a big thing nowadays. Lots of people are doing it, and but it's not new. Tolkien, of course, did it, but he also wrote an essay about it called "A Secret Vice," about all these people who were doing this back in the 30s or before, just making up private languages for themselves. It really is an interesting experience to try and figure out what your own language can do that, you know, the spoken languages you hear around don't do. So it started as that, and then I figured I'd use it in the book.
Well, if you create a language correctly, someone in Norway will put on a musical.
I don't know if there's the vocabulary of Dwarvish is that big yet. But yeah, more like we'll have to go home someday, and there will be a lot of Dwarvish in that book, I should think.
Just as a side note, the whole Klingon language thing. Yeah. I don't know if you ever heard about this. They came to this guy and they said, "We need you to build a language because we're going to do this. It's going to be the last Star Trek movie, and it's the Undiscovered Country, and we're going to do it. It's going to have a lot of Klingon in it. We need the Klingon language." So this guy sits down and he creates the entire Klingon language. He creates the whole thing, and he goes back to them and they're like, "Great, here's the script, and one of the pivotal lines is from Shakespeare, 'To be or not to be,' and he didn't actually have anything in the language for you to be able to say 'to be.'"
Yeah, I as I understand it, Hebrew doesn't have an infinitive to be either.
And so he had to change the language to create that so that they could have that line in the movie.
Excellent.
Yeah.
And there's your nerd tidbit for the week, courtesy of Patrick Hester.
Yeah. And James, it struck me when I came across the first bit of Dwarvish in the book because, gosh, it must have been about a year or two ago. As our listeners know, I write songs about science fiction and fantasy stuff. And Lou Anders, who I know well, actually commissioned me to write a song for Mike Resnick's Starship series of books, and it appears in the appendix there. I guess he must have just contracted you out for Blood of Ambrose, because as we were sort of putting the song together for Resnick's book, Lou had emailed me. He's like, Can you come up with some music for a Dwarvish ballad? And I'm like, what? And I know what he's talking about. And I said, like, I'll try. I don't know. So I'm assuming it was your book. And I think, you know, there was some stuff going on where timelines got all kind of screwy with the release of your book, and it didn't end up happening for whatever reason or another. But I'm pretty sure, you know, it was your book, because I'm like, oh, Lou must have wanted me to put some music to this line here, because there's like a Dwarvish, like a verse of a Dwarvish song in the beginning, and it struck me as quite funny. And so I was really kind of hooked into that and looking for it. But I think that adds such a sense of authenticity to a novel, having those languages. And The other thing that I liked about it in terms of creating the world is in some of the appendices that do appear in the book, you talk a little bit about the world. You talk about the three moons mm-hmm. that are in there. Where'd you get that idea from? I mean, is there any particular source that you took that from, or is it just, you know, purely something fun? Because it seems so real to me, and I thought that added such a – for something that is very sword and sorcery and very sort of classic and, you know, having those three moons add this, like, little bit of sci-fi-ishness to it that I really found quite appealing. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about that.
Well, one of the I did it on purpose because I found myself bogged down by the world. I kept thinking of it as Earth. And then I said to myself, wait a second, this is not Earth. That's the whole point, is for it not to be Earth. So I gave the world this three moons, and it's also flat or shield shaped instead of round. I stole that from C.S. Lewis because apparently the world of Narnia is also flat. It comes up in, is it Dawn Treader? I forget. Anyway, so I wanted to create a permanent reminder to myself that this is not Earth and things don't have to operate in an earthly manner. The history is not earthly. The physics is not earthly. The astronomy is not earthly. So I was originally a reminder to myself. And then I kind of like the pattern, and the three moons mean different things sort of to different people. So it did turn out being a lot of fun. I'm sort of an astronomy buff, a naked eye astronomy buff, and it was fun to create my own cosmos.
That is cool. Yeah. Getting back to the language for just a second, did you draw from any other authors who've created kind of dwarvish languages before?
No, I tried to keep it sort of northern sounding because I figure that works for dwarves because they're sort of a northern myth. And also I wanted to include some things like aspect that I'd been studying in my linguistics classes. So I toss some stuff like that in there. And enclitic words, I like enclitic words, words that are tacked onto other words.
It seems to me whenever I read a story and someone has dwarves in it and dwarves speaking their own languages, it always reminds me of German because they always sound so angry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, consonantal, you know, all these crunchy, yeah. Knobbly words. Yeah, yeah.
That's just kind of out there. It just boggles my mind to think about trying to create a language. So I guess my hat's off to you because that seems really difficult.
Well, if I make a grammatical mistake, who's going to know?
Exactly.
I figured, what the heck?
Well, you would know.
That's true, and I wouldn't be able to sleep. You know, I'd be phoning Lou in the middle of the night. Oh, we've got to change it. We've got to change it. That's why I didn't want to get his phone number.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, James, why don't you tell us a little bit? Because I know there are two more books out so far, Morlock books. Well, is the third one out yet, or is that due to come out?
No, it's
soon?
Not out yet. It comes out mid October, I think. That's the Wolf Age. That's the third one.
That's got a beautiful, beautiful cover, by the way.
Yeah, Dominic Harmon did all three covers for the Pyre books. But I mean, I like all three of them. I like the bluish color of the first one, and I like the dragon and the skulls on the second one. But really, I think he outdid himself with the third one, which has got Morlock surrounded by werewolves. Mm-hmm. I love that so much. I put it into the book after he completed it. I retrofitted it into the text in chapter two.
Awesome. Cool. So what can you tell us about those books? If someone who maybe has read Blood of Ambrose like myself, but hasn't read the other two books yet, what can we sort of look forward to in these two novels without giving anything away?
Well, the second book.
Just make it hard on him, John. God. don't give anything away, but don't give anything away, but make us salivate about him.
Let's see here. The second book, you see, you know, as an old school sword and sorcery buff, the way I got these stories, the Fritz Leiber stories and the Conan stories through the Lancer editions, not through the more recent, more correct editions that have come out from Del Rey, Wandering Star, they were presented as episodic novels, continuous narration of stories that sort of stitch together a narrative. And I love that form, the episodic novel. Me and seven other people on the planet love that form. So I wanted to write one. So I'd already planned on the Blackgate stories fitting into an overarching plot, which is in the background of all the stories, but didn't affect the foreground plot. So I stitched a bunch of them and some other stuff, lots of other stuff, actually, like 2/3 of the stuff is new, into an episodic novel, and that's This Crooked Way. So the first Morlock story appears in This Crooked Way, stitched in with the other episodes. And I love this form, but lots of people find it frustrating. A very sympathetic reviewer, I was just reading a very sympathetic review, he referred to throwing the book across the room because of the episodic structure, but he ended up liking it. But that's a lot to demand from people for a sword and sorcery book, maybe.
Mm. And you have I believe there's a Morlock story in the Swords and Dark Magic collection that that Lou has out, the short story collection?
Right. He's a drunk. He's mostly on the wagon in stories that had been published before that. But I wanted to write a couple of stories about Morlock as a drunk. And mm-hmm. one of them appeared in Flashing Swords and later in a collection from Rogue Blade Enterprises called The Return of the Sword. That one is called The Red Worm's Way. And Morlock is... he behaves very badly in that story, and I wanted to write another story like that where he behaved even worse. And the Singing Spear was that story where he's just an irresponsible drunk drinking himself to death until something happens that sort of makes him take action again. That one, I was surprised at how well it was received. I mean, it's on the table of contents with people like, you know, Glenn Cook and Michael Moorcock and Tanith Lee and, you know, all these legends, you know, but every now and then someone says, oh, I really like this story, which is awesome.
And I have to admit, I do have that book, the anthology. Mm-hmm. I'm about a third of it through, but mm-hmm. I'm taking it really slow, so I don't think I've gotten to that one yet.
Hmm. Well, I don't know. It's a lot of sword and sorcery at one gulp.
So it is. And
divided time is a good idea, I think.
I've been reading one story, and then I switch to something else. And then I go back and read another story, which is kind of good because, I mean, it does give you a chance to break it up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, normally when you're reading a book, you're obviously going to read the whole thing. But since this is, you know, so many different characters from so many different mm-hmm. universes, I'm kind of breaking it up. So it's kind of funny because right now I've got a couple different anthologies on my nightstand. One of them is The Improbable Adventures of Sherlock Holmes.
Oh, yeah? That's John Joseph Adams?
I believe it is, yes.
Yeah.
And then, so that's got people like Stephen King writing a Sherlock Holmes story. And so it can be a little bit strange bouncing from, you know, something from the sword and sorcery book and then going over to the Sherlock Holmes book and reading that. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, it's, but for my brain, it works well.
A sword and sorcery Sherlock Holmes book should be possible. I mean, he was a master swordsman among his other things Doyle never actually narrated.
And actually, the BBC just did a Sherlock series where they placed him in modern day England.
Oh, really?
So, oh, yeah. And I mean, it was very well done. It's by Stephen Moffat. I mean, it hasn't yet come to BBC America, and I plan to check it out when it does.
we'll inquire no further.
Yes. But Stephen Moffat, who did Coupling and just recently did the Doctor Who Series 5, created the whole dang thing. And, I mean, if they can put him in modern-day London, why wouldn't they be able to put him in, you know, a sword and sorcery story?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, so, James, we have the two Morlock novels out, a third one on the way. You have some short stories out there. What else? Is there anything else that you have going on that's in the works that you'd like to tell us about?
Well, nothing that's been accepted, so I'm superstitious about talking about it. But okay. I've got some historical fantasies that I'm working on and one straight historical novel with no magic in it whatsoever, which I wanted to set myself the task of not being able to break the laws of physics for my own convenience.
Are we talking about like the Pillars of the Earth here or...?
Let's see here. It's set in the late Roman Republic.
Ooh, okay. I'd read that.
Well, good deal. I'll mention that in my cover letter.
You got one person totally willing to buy it right now.
sight unseen. Yeah.
Excellent. Might be a good time for that stuff with Spartacus, Blood and Sand, and all that stuff. So who knows?
Well, yeah. I mean, you just had the Spartacus. You also had, like I said, the Pillars of the Earth, which was just on Stars. And I guess they're going to do a season 2 of Spartacus.
Yeah, although I heard the star is having some health problems, so there's an issue there.
Yes, he has, I believe he has cancer.
Yeah, yeah. Mm.
Yeah.
Mm. All right, so we have all that coming out. Now, do you have any convention appearances coming up that maybe some people could find out about?
Such as something in Ohio?
Yeah, the World Fantasy Convention, of course, is in Columbus. So I had already bought a membership about a month before the nominations came out. I figured it was wasted money. But I should go if I was going to be in Ohio, and it was going to be in Ohio.
You should.
So now I'm definitely going to go.
I wish we were going.
Oh, we are going, Patrick. Remember?
Oh yeah, yeah. There you go. Yeah.
Hey. Seriously, really?
Yes. Yeah, we're both going. Yeah, we'll be there. So we'll definitely have to meet up and have a drink and hang out there and maybe interview you again. We do the SF Signal podcast as well, so maybe we can pull you aside and maybe take a little short interview and throw you onto the SF Signal podcast as well.
We were thinking about
the last blow of my luster as a nominee. I don't mean to sound pessimistic, but I mean there's some marvelous work on the list with me, and I figure one of those guys will take the trophy home. But it is kind of cool to be in their company.
We were thinking about getting all the Pyre folks together, getting them drunk, and having them tell us Luander stories.
Yeah, well, most of my Luander stories are fictional. if not absolutely hallucinations, so that's my fallback position in case there's some legal trouble.
So in addition to World Fantasy, any other conventions that you're planning on going on?
I have not been a very big convention goer. Dragon Con this past Labor Day weekend was my first big one. I went to Raven Con earlier this year, and I might well go back because that was a great con. There are great people at that convention.
Great. Where is RavenCon anyway? Where is that located?
RavenCon's in Richmond, Virginia.
Okay. For some reason, I thought you were going to say Baltimore.
Well, there's a big Poe theme there, but of course, Richmond was more Poe's hometown than Baltimore was. So there's a sort of tugging rivalry about Poe between those guys.
That's like Buffalo Bill Cody and Denver and I forget what the city is up in Montana or something. You know, they fought over Buffalo Bill Cody and, you know, where did he really live? I mean, that's just ridiculous. Baltimore.
That's part of the hero myth. Which city gets the hero? I mean, they do the same thing over Hercules. They did the same thing over Dante. You know, after kicking him out, Florence wanted Dante back, but Ravenna, where he died, said, "We're not letting him go." So there's a huge monumental tomb to Dante in Florence with no body inside it, because they didn't get they want their hero, but they haven't got him yet.
You go up on Lookout Mountain, just west of Denver, and that's where Buffalo Bill Cody's gravesite is. Uh-huh. And they actually have pictures of when they buried him. They had tanks here. They called in the National Guard. They were afraid that they were going to come and steal the body and take it to another city.
Ah, for all we know, it's actually happened since then.
Who knows? Well, now, you said they were upset about Hercules. What about Heracles?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, they're the same guy. as an English speaker, I tend to use the Latin form. And the truth is, I'm a Latinist to the last drop of my heart's reddest blood. So
you would have
think more Latin than Greek usually.
You would have loved my teacher, and I don't know, she could still be alive. Hopefully she is, and still out there teaching. But she actually taught us Latin as a spoken language.
Oh, excellent.
Which people, you know, I mean, it's not a spoken language. She taught French, and she taught Latin. Mm-hmm. And there was just the one Latin class, and in order for there to be a second tier for it, she had to have a full first tier class. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we were full, and so she was able to offer, you know, the second tier the following year. Unfortunately, I was graduating, so I didn't get to take that. Mm. But she taught it as a spoken word, and, you know, we would go out and we would go out on the field and we would play volleyball. Mm-hmm. But we would have to speak to each other only in Latin and not in English. And she took us, this was in Fresno, California, and she took us to the Getty Museum in L.A.
Oh, wow.
And so we got to go there and see all the Roman and Greek architecture. And that's actually a recreation of a villa, I believe, from Pompeii.
Right. Yeah, it's a beautiful place, and they have wonderful stuff there.
Oh, it's gorgeous. And then because she also taught French, we got to go with them to the Palace of the Legion of Honor in San Francisco.
Cool.
So that was awesome.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, I love Latin.
Yeah, James, I was just thinking at World Fantasy, we have to, if you don't already know him, we'll have to introduce you to Blake Charlton. Do you know Blake Charlton?
I know of him. I don't know him personally.
Okay, we've had him on the show, and I've met him in person a couple times. We went to ReaderCon together, and he's published through Tor. His book Spellwright is out, and has gotten, that's his debut novel, and he's a currently a med student, but he's also dyslexic. I don't know if you know this about his story, and you know, he eventually overcame his dyslexia. Obviously, he's a published novelist and a med student now. Sure. But he talked quite a bit about how dyslexia is more common in English than it is in a language like Italian. In a language like Italian, dyslexia is 6 times less likely to happen. And so he knows a lot about language at this point. Because he's a med student, he doesn't have too much of a problem, because so much of the, you know, the medical books that he's studying are in Latin and in Greek, and everything is written the way it sounds. So he doesn't have a problem. But I bet you guys would have a lot of interesting conversations talking about language and talking about Latin. So we'll have to get you two guys together to have a conversation. I would love to be there for that. But
I love its writing system makes no sense whatsoever. Mm-hmm. It's amazing to me that anyone can make sense of it.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So, James, why don't you throw out a website and your Twitter and all that kind of stuff so people can maybe contact you that way?
Oh, sure. My website is cunningly named jamesang.com. That's jamesenge. .com. Mm-hmm. I'm also James Eng, jamesenge on Twitter. And I think I had to be James.Eng on Facebook for reasons that I never fully understood, but I don't understand anything about Facebook.
Magic.
Yeah. Maybe when I see the movie, you know, it'll all become clear. But anyway, I think on Facebook, I'm james.enge.
Okay, awesome. Cool. Well, Patrick, what do you have going on this week?
They of course got the blog, atfmb.com, and what did I put up there? I put up pictures of Echo Lake, which is near Mount Evans, which is one of our like 54 14ers here in Denver. It's a gorgeous spot, and people should go check out the picture. I have, of course, Sex in Science Fiction and the Brent Weeks interview over on sfsignal.com and the podcast, which everybody seems to be loving that particular topic. I also put up a post on SF Signal called Whatever Happened to Scary Vampires? And that is getting a lot of comments and a lot of traffic to it. And apparently someone felt that my manhood was threatened by sparkly vampires. I don't get that at all. My reply to that was like, you know, if grandpa brings a 16-year-old to Thanksgiving and says, here's my date, aren't you going to be kind of grossed out? Because that's essentially what's happening when these 100-year-old vampires are dating these 16-year-old girls.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Great scary vampire novel. I'm sorry, this is a pirate novel, so this will sound like it's base flattery, but 12 by Jasper Kent.
I've got it sitting
those
right
are scary on vampires.
Yeah, I've got that sitting on my my counter over there. I'm really looking forward to reading that one. It looks pretty awesome. So
yeah, I suggested The Strain by Guillermo del Toro.
Oh yeah.
Or 30 Days of Night, which is the graphic novel. That's kind of awesome too. For scary vampires. And Stephen King's Salem's Lot.
Oh yeah.
Which still creeps me out to this day. The little kid floating outside the window and, oh, let me in, let me in. No, no. And then, of course, with episode 154, I am now the producer over at I Should Be Writing for Mer Lafferty. So I get to hear the episodes before you do.
Cool. Cool. Well, this week.
Oh, John.
Yeah.
Twitter.com/JTFMB.
Oh, sorry. Of course. Yeah. This week you could still, I have my album up over on Bandcamp. So if you go to johnanilio.bandcamp.com, you can pay what you want for it. So if you want to throw me a few bucks, you could do that. If you want to get it for free, you could do that. It's also available on iTunes and Amazon MP3 and all those places. So just type in my name, John Anilio, or Sci-Fi Songs, and you can get it that way. I'm on Twitter at twitter.com/JohnAnilio. The Clash of the Geeks chat book is still available, which is the short story collection where the sheet music to My Unicorn Pegasus Kitten song appears alongside short stories by John Scalzi and Will Wheaton and Patrick Rothfuss and lots of other cool people.
And that's from Subterranean, right?
Subterranean Press, yeah, that's out through them. And the other thing, which I don't even know if I've talked about it on the Functional Nerds podcast yet, I might have, but I'm now doing a video blog for Wired Magazine's Geek Dad blog. And it's called Geek Guitar Lessons, or Geek Dad Guitar Lessons, I should say. And every 2 weeks I teach a, do a video teaching a sort of geeky song. So far I've done the theme song from Firefly and Rocket Man by Elton John. And by the time this airs,
and I think it's going to be a long, long time.
And you teach the Shatner mannerisms along with it, or are they extra?
I did not. I hewed closer to the Elton John original than the Shatner version, although it's hard not to hear that song without hearing the Shatner version. Of
and
that.
Seeing it.
And seeing it, yes, of course.
I am the Rocket Man.
But by the time this podcast goes live, my third one should be up there. And that, because it will be October, I'm trying to do all sort of Halloween-ish themed songs or just sort of horror themed songs. So this week you will get Werewolves of London by Warren Zevon. Yes, and you get to hear me sing and howl like a wolf in it. So if nothing else, it's entertainment to see me howl. But that's what I have going on this week.
Are you going to do the Monster Mash?
I'm going to try to stay away from the Monster Mash. I'm going to try to like do some other outside of the box ones, but I may end up doing that anyway. But
so. I just this moment right now, I figured out what crestfallen means.
Really?
I was crestfallen when I heard you say that.
Okay. Sorry about that. Well, maybe I'll do it just for you, Patrick. How about that?
Okay. You need to do the other song I told you to do. That's perfect for Halloween.
Okay, I'll think about it because I was thinking of doing that. But
just the intro part. It's easy. Anybody can learn the intro part.
Okay, all right.
If I can learn it, anybody can learn it.
I'll think about it. Okay. All right. Well, James, thanks so much for joining us again, and we look forward to seeing you at World Fantasy. We should have a good time.
Absolutely. This is great. Thanks a lot, guys.
And thanks, James, for offering to buy the first round. We appreciate that.
Yes. Sure. With Fantasy.
All right. We'll see you all next time. Have a good week.
Good deal.
Bye.
Bye.
Sometimes one film isn't enough. I don't want a sequel if it's only fluff. Though I love these characters, a third installment of this franchise should have never occurred. I love Star Wars, not the prequels. I love the Matrix, but hated the sequels. Why does science fiction coming in threes? We don't need another trilogy. We don't need another trilogy.
Was fantastic. Part 2 announced, man, I can't wait to catch it. Famous last words, you know they're gonna screw it up. There's like a handful of good trilogies, the rest suck. I'm saying, really, it's rarely a good thing. I die a little each time I see it, like The Ring. Sure, it comes down to if the flick succeeds, but really, who are these asking for three species? It's been a few years, they'll probably reboot. No character depth, just dress it up and shoot. And each time we hope it's just better. Now Transformers talk about a trilogy of terror. How had me all excited. Now when this is what you bring back, I should have known it fall flat. They didn't cast a Wheeljack. And it's ironic that I'd like to forget, and my only hope relies on the butterfly effect. I love Star Wars.